supporting inventors and invention to improve lives in the U.S. and developing countries, on the web at lemelson.org.
This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. According to the United Nations, every minute, 8 people leave everything behind to escape war, persecution, or terror. They become refugees. And again, the UN says their numbers are enormous. The United Nations says that some 43 million people have been displaced due to conflicts, with nearly a million seeking asylum just in 2011. Last year, 618 of those folks ended up in Charlotte. We're going to meet a few of those people this hour, along with several of those who help refugees make the transition to a new life in Charlotte. Sierra Ponce is Director of Refugee Resettlement for Catholic Charities. That's the service of the Catholic Diocese of Charlotte. Welcome back to the program.
Thank you.
Ellen Dubin is Executive Director of the Carolina Refugee Resettlement Agency, a wholly owned subsidiary of the Hebrew Immigrant Aid Society. No, that's wrong?
It's wrong.
You need to change your website, because that's where I got that.
We used to be a wholly owned subsidiary, but we no longer are.
Okay, well, you need to change your website. Okay. Jose Osmani is a refugee from Havana, Cuba, who came here, I think. I've gotten conflicting reports on this, so Jose, you can correct me. Came here 12 years ago when he was 10, right? Or 10 years ago when he was 12?
It was 12 years ago when I was 10.
Okay, got it. And your father was a political prisoner.
That is correct,
Cuba.
Yeah.
And also with us is Mator, I'm going to try this, Mator Jenquick.
Junkwa, yeah.
Okay, Junkwa, close.
Good job.
A refugee from South Sudan and a member of the so-called Lost Boys. That's the name given to over 20,000 boys who were displaced and or orphaned during the Second Sudanese Civil War from the 80s to the 2005. That term was used again as children fled the post-independence violence of South Sudan with Sudan from 2011 to 12. Mator resettled in the United States in 2001. And in July 2001, actually, he eventually left for Charlotte because of the snow in Cleveland. Is that right?
Yeah.
I don't blame you. Who wouldn't?
That's correct.
Who wouldn't resettle from Cleveland for that and other reasons? Well, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
11,000 refugees have come through Catholic Charities in Charlotte from 26 different countries. Does anybody know how many refugees have settled in Charlotte in total over the years?
We were just talking about that, and we resettled nearly 3,000 since 1996, but there have been so many secondary migrants that have come here that we really don't know what the total number is.
And when they settle in Charlotte, when they come to Charlotte initially, is this usually their first stopping off point, or is it a second or third stopping off point? And when they come here as a first point, do they then move elsewhere, or do they pretty much stay here?
The majority of the refugees that come to Charlotte stay in Charlotte. We have very low out-migration.
Why?
Well, I think when we've asked our clients that question, they have a variety of reasons. One is they like the welcoming aspect of our community, as well as the refugee community that also embraces them and the immigrant community. They love the climate, and there's also employment opportunities that they take advantage of and do very well and thrive here. And many of them, through lots of hard work, have been able to learn the language, continue their education, prosper in their jobs, and build their new lives here. Oftentimes, as well as purchasing homes, so they really make Charlotte a home.
Well, we're going to talk a lot about all these things that you just mentioned, but it seems to me that a lot of these refugees come here with a language barrier and with a cultural barrier. They're not from this part of the world. Their traditions and their customs and what they understood life to be is very different from what life in the United States is like and what life in Charlotte is like. So what kinds of jobs do they get that makes this area so welcoming and a good place to remain once they get here?
Initially, most of them get entry-level positions, many of which American citizens don't want or don't last in for very long. A lot of them are working in distribution centers. We have many who are working in a poultry plant outside of Mecklenburg County. Some work in a greenhouse, although that's seasonal work. But at least it's an initial income and a way that they can start paying their bills and becoming economically self-sufficient.
And many of these folks, I'm assuming, not all of them were entry-level skilled workers in their native country. Some of them perhaps were doctors or lawyers and require language skills and degrees in this country and certificates in this country that are very difficult to get for a newcomer. So talk to me about the psychological aspect of adjusting to life here after having gone through, and we'll talk about what they go through to get here, but after having gone through what they went through in their home countries, after what they've gone through to get here, and the ropes, the hoops they've had to jump through, what's life like psychologically?
I think it depends on the individual, of course. It depends on the country that they came from, on what their life had been like pre whatever caused them to flee, what their life was like when they had to flee and, you know, when they were in transition, and then what their expectations were when they first came here. So there are a lot of variables. But generally speaking, and I think that that the young men who have gone through this themselves would agree, and Sierra has seen it as well, many of them, when they arrive, are elated. They're happy. They're relieved that they're finally free. They feel a sense of peace. But at the same time, they're also very worried. How will I learn the language if they don't speak English? How will I adjust to this culture? Will I make friends? Will I have a job? Who's going to help me? What's going to happen to me? How will I support my family? How will my children do in school? And our caseworkers work with them, and of course we introduce them to other members of the community. And as they're adjusting, they're coming down a little bit, but they're also, many will plateau. Then others will suddenly realize everything that they gave up, that they lost their families, that is their extended families. They'll probably never be able to go back to their home country, even if they left the home country in terrible conditions. But the realization right. that it's changed and that they're changing.
I'm going to talk to Jose and Mator about their own situations in a moment or two, but you're with the Carolina Refugee Resettlement Agency, Ellen. It's a private organization. Sierra, you're with Refugee Resettlement with Catholic Charities, both non-governmental organizations. How many other non-governmental organizations are there in Charlotte who do what you do?
We're the only ones.
The only two organizations. Mm-hmm. And why are there non-governmental organizations involved in this? Why doesn't the government handle this? Given all the hoops that you have to jump through to get here that are government-sponsored hoops, why don't they then carry the ball to the finish line? Why do they hand it over to you?
Well, the government has invited faith-based organizations and nonprofits to resettle refugees for the purpose of that it really does need to be a community effort, and it does require that welcoming aspect that volunteers and the community as a whole, as well as staff, can offer. And it really does take a private and public partnership for resettlement to happen well. And with all those efforts, we do receive funding through the government, but it's certainly something that has to be considered in our planning mm-hmm. and our management.
Is it enough funding?
There's never enough funding.
Of course not. define refugee. Who makes the decision on who is and who is not a refugee, and who decides who qualifies to come here as a refugee? Is that all the government?
Yes.
How do they define it?
A refugee is a person who has a well-founded fear of persecution. Can be for reasons of race, religion, nationality. They've basically had to flee their country due to being in danger. It could be due to violence and war, threats. And, of course, as you mentioned earlier, many of them experience a lot of trauma,
yeah.
both physical and psychological trauma.
Now, as I understand it, both of you, Jose and Matar, came here as refugees, and both of you have family who remain in your case in Cuba, in your case in Sudan. One of your stories I read said that those family members remaining behind don't want to come here. I think it was your story, Matar, where those family members that you still know about, who still remain in that part of the world, really don't want to come here. Is that your story that I'm remembering?
Actually, I want to narrate it down. Like it was my mom. It was not like everybody. Everybody want to come to the United States if they can, but they don't have the same opportunity.
But your mother.
I was talking about my mom.
She didn't want to come.
I mean, she had more a family back there, like nieces. Grandkid that she will be prepared to stay around them, mm-hmm. then come here and live with me alone. That's why it's one of the things she's not coming here. But it's not like she don't want to come to the United States, but in for her to come and live in the United States where she don't speak English, she have to create others, make friends.
Mm-hmm.
She don't see it that way. So that's why she's not here.
And maybe your story is extraordinary because you are one of the so-called lost boys who were being targeted by the bad guys in the Sudanese civil war. Your mother wasn't being targeted by these people?
Absolutely. We all targeted, and that's why I was separated from them. When we talk about the name Lost Boy,
uh-huh.
it was not like they're lost going to where they go. They're lost because they don't have parents.
Right.
During the war, when the war broke out, based on our culture, pretty much all the young boys, they went up to Carol, and then when the war broke out, there's no chance that they can go back home to see their parent, and that's how escape came, whereby I separate most of the young boy, which I call lost boy,
mm-hmm.
and they go to refugee camp.
Mm-hmm.
So pretty much that's what it is.
Go ahead.
But yeah, I mean, we do have parents, and some of them, they didn't see their parent for 20-some years. And that's pretty much what happened.
You came to the United States, Jose, 12 years ago. Your father arrived, I think, before you by about 3 years. He was here 15 years, and he'd been imprisoned for 25 years.
That is correct, yeah.
In Cuba for organizing and demonstrating for democracy.
Correct.
How did he get out of the country?
So basically, after my father completes his 25-year sentence, he tries to live in the island for a little while. Having something like that on your record, though, it's worse than having a criminal record here in the United States. The jobs that you basically qualify for are jobs that will guarantee that you will have a horrible life in a horrible country.
Is that because they are afraid of hiring you? Employers are afraid of hiring you for what the regime might think, or because they side with the regime and don't want anything to do with you?
The exact reason, I'm not sure.
Mm-hmm.
It could be for political reasons that they don't want any kind of company or anything like that. Having an employee such as that, the exact reason I'm not sure, but it's actually real. It's there.
Yeah.
We'll
come back and get the rest of that story in a moment or two because we have to take a break. That's Jose Hosmani, who is a refugee from Havana. Matar Chenquick is a refugee from Sudan. Ellen Dubin with Carolina Refugee Resettlement Agency and Ciro Ponce, Director of Refugee Resettlement for Catholic Charities in Charlotte. We're coming right back. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Lenore Ryan University graduate programs offering master's degrees in a variety of disciplines from the Hickory, Asheville, and Columbia, South Carolina campuses. Details at lr.edu/graduate. And James McElroy and Deal, a law firm helping individuals and businesses avoid problems, overcome obstacles, and minimize consequences. For over 50 years, jmdlaw.com. One of the most scenic highways in America passes through North Carolina. The Blue Ridge Parkway holds some of the most beautiful vistas, historic sites, and cultural treasures in the state. 14 million people visit the area around the parkway each year, and we'll hear more about what the Blue Ridge Parkway has to offer first in the program tomorrow, and then we'll find out about the Uptown Jazz Festival, which kicks off this weekend for the fourth year. That's all tomorrow at 9.
On the next Ay and Ream show, the broad reach of sequestration, how across-the-board spending cuts are affecting Meals on Wheels, medical research, national parks, and other programs.
Join the Diane Rehm Show this morning from 10 to noon after Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE, Charlotte's NPR news source.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Tomorrow is World Refugee Day, and we're talking about refugees in Charlotte today with two folks who have resettled here, one from Havana, Cuba, Jose Hosmani, and also with the Mata Awan. I'm going to call him Awan because that's your middle name, and that's what people in America call you as opposed to Jen Quetch,
right,
which is your
last name.
Last name. Okay, we'll make it easy. We had a whole conversation about names before this program started, which maybe we'll talk a little bit about on the air. Ellen Dubin is also with us, along with Sarah Ponce. They're both with agencies who help refugees resettle in Charlotte. We were talking to Jose before the break about his father being a political prisoner for 25 years in Cuba, finally getting out of jail, facing a life in Cuba that was not very bright because he was a political prisoner in jail in Cuba, and when you get out in that situation, nobody wants to hire you for anything that will give you a decent life. So he came here, but how did you and he both get out of the country?
So I believe it was in the late 90s, I think it was 98, 99, the United States basically had a program in place that if you lived in a communist country and you could prove to the United States government that you were against that government, they would grant you asylum under refugee status. My father had applied for that program, and, you know.
How do you do that in Cuba where we don't have an embassy and where Americans are not allowed to visit as vacationers? How do you make contact?
I was very young when I came. I know there was I don't know if it was an embassy, but there was a place that you went to, mm-hmm, that I think kind of had relations with the United States.
Okay.
And it was through that place that you applied for this program. Mm-hmm. Now,
and aren't you automatically, I would think, mm-hmm, that if your father is a political prisoner or has been one, mm-hmm, he's being watched.
Right.
So you're approaching these people with connections to the United States, it seems to me, would be watched, would be observed, would be noted.
That's correct. So it's
pretty scary stuff.
It's a very tough situation. At the end of the day, I mean, going back to the question you asked me, why the companies won't hire somebody like that, you have to keep in mind that after the Castro regime, everything in Cuba became government-owned.
Right.
So if everything is government-owned, then hiring somebody who was against the government is kind of like hiring somebody who's against that company. So, yeah, when he goes to apply for these things, you do feel a sense of patrol, like you're being watched.
Uh-huh.
But at the same time, it's kind of expected when you kind of live this life for the past 25 years.
So your father got out and came here, and 3 years later you got out and came here. How did that happen? Why didn't you go with him initially, et cetera?
So initially my father gets approved under the as a refugee to the United States. I do not get automatically approved because he has to file a petition to bring me over. So he can file a petition based on me being his son, but that requires a different application and a different process. That was actually the toughest part of the entire situation because me being young, the government believed that I was completely innocent, at least in Cuba, and had nothing to do with them. So they did everything they could to prevent me from coming.
You were 7 when he left.
Yes.
Obviously, as a young person, probably didn't have a real understanding of politics.
I did not at the time, no.
So you just knew that your father wasn't in Cuba anymore and that you wanted to go where he was?
Correct.
And why would the government say yes to that? Why would they let you leave?
So I think the program at the time, it was after the Soviet collapse, mm-hmm, and the United States was giving some form of aid to Cuba. It wasn't a complete aid, but there was some form of help there. and the Cuba did not want to, did not want to cause tension with the United States. So they wanted to, at least by their part, complete with that program. Mm-hmm. At the same time, I had skipped two grades. I was showing high intelligence in schools and stuff like that. So when in Cuba, when you do anything like that, the government does not let you leave. They only let leave like the political refugees and people who've been in prison. But anybody who shows any kind of potential right. or they could contribute to the island are actually not allowed to leave. College students are not allowed to leave mm-hmm. to any other country, I think, other than Venezuela, which is an ally of Cuba
right.
and Argentina, I believe. I'm not sure. But any country like Europe or any country in Europe or the United States, you're definitely not out of visit. So I remember I was interrogated by immigration officers in Cuba on several different occasions through this whole process, where at 7, 8, and 9, they would basically let me know, are you aware that your father is a political refugee? Are you aware that your father is a traitor to the nation? And these kind of things are what...
And what goes through your head when you're 8 years old and they're telling you your dad's a bad guy?
That, I mean, it's very tough.
What did your mom say to that?
That's, my mom would always tell me that those are all lies. My mom always stood behind me and my father. She actually talked to me and basically explained to me that my father and her had a conversation about which country I should live in. They had sat down and basically talked whether I should live or stay.
She is still there, right?
No, actually, she passed away last year.
But she was in Cuba when she passed away?
She was. She was not allowed to come because my father and her had divorced several years back. So she was not. He was not allowed to petition her for entrance
What
here.
Was her life like in Cuba after her husband first, then her son? And do you have siblings?
I do.
They're there as well?
Correct. Additionally, if you are in the military age, you are not actually allowed to leave Cuba. So that was the obstacle between my siblings that could not come. Mm-hmm. Now, my father has gone back and visited, but my siblings are not allowed to come. I think my oldest brother, who is now, I believe, 35, he can now come. And my father is, we're investigating to see what we have to do to petition him to come. But, I mean, going back to the question of my mother, I mean, that was very tough. I actually never got to see my mother again. I left very young, and she passed away. It was very, very, very tough.
I'm very sorry. Do you have conversations with your siblings?
I do. I talk to all of them on a regular basis, at least as much as I can. Calling Cuba is very expensive.
Would they leave if they could?
They would if they could. I think a lot of people in Cuba would leave if they could.
Even though I'm sure they have heard the stories of how difficult it was when your father arrived. How difficult was it when your father arrived?
I mean, it's coming to a different country. You have to, keep in mind that most, if not all, of political refugees who come here, they don't have anything left in their country. So they're coming here with absolutely nothing. These programs that are put in place are very, very, very helpful. And without those programs, I think it would be a disaster for us to be here.
Your story, Matur, is completely different it's brutal. Your passage from Sudan to the United States was long and difficult. Your village was attacked during the Civil War, as I understand. I should let you tell the story. The Muslim-controlled government in northern Sudan were fighting against the non-Muslim liberation movement. You and your brother separated from the rest of your family and escaped to Ethiopia on foot.
Right.
How long a distance? How far? How great a distance is that?
Wow. Actually, in age 7.
Mm-hmm. Age 7.
Yeah, how it was hard.
How old was your brother?
My brother, he was like 15, around that 15 to 14.
Why were you separated from your parents in the first place? Why were you in a position to have to walk to Ethiopia from Sudan?
Well, that's what happened during our village attacks, especially in the south region of south in Sudan. Based on Dinka culture, because that's where that's a tribe I come from. Mm-hmm. When you become at least 5 years old boy, you will have to go to a cattle camp.
Cattle camp?
Yeah, whereby you have to look after cattle, and pretty much mothers and fathers, they will stay home, taking care of farming, and because that's life in a village.
So, in other words, your job at that age is to take care of the cattle.
Absolutely.
Okay.
Absolutely. Same to my brother too.
Okay.
So when the war, when the attack came out, so those cattle camp are not like 5 miles away from the village. They are at least a couple hours away from the village.
Mm-hmm.
So whereby if you have to go home to see your parents, sometimes you have to go for days.
Mm-hmm.
So after the attack, we didn't have a chance to go there anymore because for insecurity purposes, because you get killed if you go there.
How do you know this at that age?
My brother told me a lot of things because I asked him a lot of questions.
Is your brother here now?
Yeah, he's here in Charlotte.
Okay.
Yeah. I asked him, where's mom? Where's my sister?
Uh-huh.
Where, you know, and I already seen it, the smoke. I hear gunshot and, you know, and all of those. So I know that something happened.
Okay.
Yeah. And after there, we found some people too. You know, in the cattle camp, it's not just like boys. There's all some people that grown there and they show us, you know, let's go this way.
So you followed followed everybody to
actually I followed my brother. Whatever he told me, let's go this way
to Ethiopia. How long did it take you to get to Ethiopia on foot?
It was almost a month because it was a long walk.
What did you eat?
We got some food on our way going because during we ran out in a cattle camp and those cattle are gone.
And what
we
is the, some what's food. The terrain like between Sudan and Ethiopia? Is it jungle? Is it grassland?
It was jungle. It was pretty much jungle on our walk going to Ethiopia. It was pretty much jungle. And when we go to a refugee camp called Fanyudu, which I didn't mention in that live story, I forget to mention it.
Okay.
It was even a jungle. It was just it was not like a town or nothing.
That
it was just like a village.
You spent 4 years
before,
in that refugee camp.
Yeah, before the war broke out in Ethiopia.
What were the conditions in the camp?
It was terrible. It was terrible. A lot of people died. A lot of kids thinking homesick, missing parent.
How did you deal with that?
My brother always motivated me and keep me strong by telling me tomorrow will be better than today. Keep me hoping, bring some food. But if they don't taste good.
4 years of hearing tomorrow will be better than today.
Yeah, but what happened is we had a United Nations High Commissioner for Refugee and Red Cross. They supplied some of our food for the, you know. It wasn't enough, but they give us some corn, sorghum, and something like that.
And what? How old were you then?
4 years. To 11 years.
So you were 11 years old.
Yeah.
And what does an 11-year-old know what to do with sorghum?
Eat it.
How?
You have to eat it, you know. Don't taste good, eat it.
You were there for 4 years. War breaks out in Ethiopia.
Right.
That forces you to flee back
to Sudan. As our way, there's no other way we can travel to Kenya, so we have to go back to Sudan. We didn't go to our village where we were born. We passed the other side of Sudan.
Why? Because it was too far away, or because
it's too far
still
away?
Too dangerous.
It's too far away, and it's too dangerous too.
And you arrived in Kenya in 1992. I'm not sure how long that took you to go from Ethiopia through Sudan to Kenya,
it was about a month. It wasn't
month.
That too far.
Again, on foot.
Yeah, on foot.
And you spent 9 years.
Yes, in
the camp in Kenya.
Right. What happened during our trip from Ethiopia to Kenya, which I mentioned there, we lost a lot of friends during suffering from attack from Helmand, Malaysia, some drone. The Red Cross did a good job. So they've supplied some fuel. We call them lorry, like pickup truck to help others, people, those who cannot move anymore. But they were not enough, so they have us.
So you spent 13 years of your very young life at the time in refugee camps.
Absolutely.
In very substandard conditions and in eating food that I don't even understand. 9 years in Kenya with a meager ration of corn mush and lentils.
Right.
You were able to go to school for the first time in Kenya.
Yeah, absolutely. I never went to school. I remember my first time to go to take a class. I was about almost 15 years old to start ABCD. I never attend any school for any kind, but it was interesting. Pretty much being in a refugee camp, one thing I can say, it does kill dream for any child living there. I'm not meaning they don't have dream. You have a dream. what you want to be. But if you look ahead, you know, in that situation, you live while you struggle of what to eat tomorrow.
Right.
It's really hard to think about what else you need to do.
And what are the living conditions in places like that?
Everything is inadequate. Nothing really enough. I mean, I know the United Nations and UNHCR, they supply food, they're trying, because from all the donations come from United States, other part of the world, like clothes, other things, have to be donated to for United Nations to take it to us.
Right.
And they were not enough. The camp I was living in was populated about 80,000 Sudanese, and that camp only was having others, refugees from other seven countries in Africa, like Eritrean, Rwandan, Burundis,
so
Congolese.
80,000 people from various parts
of
Africa. How big was this place? This is a city.
It was pretty big. It was in the northern Kenya, a very desert place, really hot, but it was huge. It was big.
Yeah. How did you come to the attention of the United States? How did you come to be here?
That's a good question. I never fly to come to the United States, but it was an opportunity given to us by the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees and the State Department. Because what happened after many of us go to school, you can't go until 12th grade, but after 12th grade, that's it. You cannot go to college,
uh-huh.
And there's no job, too. So they see that a lot of us have potential of doing something with their life, doing good in school, but there's no other way out.
Did you have an opportunity to choose which country you would go to, or did the United States?
Not at all. But I will still choose the United States.
Why you? Why do they choose you and your brother? Because they didn't choose everybody. The 80,000 people, not all of them came.
No, not absolutely. Actually, it was not everybody at that time, but it was especially those unaccompanied minor from South Sudan, mm-hmm. which they call Lost Boy, because we were living in a minor group whereby we have to cook by ourselves, we have to do everything by ourselves, and we go to school and we don't have other option, another opportunity.
How many people that you deal with in your agency work, Ellen and Sierra, have similar stories either to Mator or to Jose?
Everybody.
Yes. Very common tragic stories that we hear every day. Many, many refugees are in refugee camps for decades.
Do you think the average person in the United States knows that? I mean, we know about refugee camps, mm-hmm. but we think, well, they're temporary. But if you're in there for decades, that's not temporary. That's your life.
Absolutely.
That's right.
Are there still people in the camp?
Absolutely.
You came from?
Yeah.
They're still there.
They're still there.
Kenya still has huge camps. And there are refugee camps in various other countries throughout the world. And some of them are larger, some of them are smaller. And
there are still political prisoners who get out because of their political beliefs, get out of their country, get out of the prison, and come to other countries. That's still happening around. What countries is that happening from?
The political?
Yeah. Very quickly, because I have 20 seconds.
Okay. Well, Cuba still. Mm-hmm. I'm just trying to think.
Burma. Bhutan.
Although the Bhutanese are primarily in refugee camps.
Okay.
Right now.
We have to take a break. We'll come back and hear more of Jose Amator's stories and also more about the refugee situation with people who do resettle here in Charlotte successfully, as these two gentlemen have. We're coming right back. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Audi of Charlotte, presenting a selection of luxury vehicles committed to customer service and satisfaction on East Independence Boulevard inside the 485 Beltway. Audi, truth in engineering. Information at audiofcharlotte.com. And Charlotte Speech and Hearing Center, providing hearing solutions since 1967, offering patient care and technology to meet any lifestyle, connecting people to the sounds of life. Charlotte Speech Hearing. .com. Coming up at 10 o'clock on the Diane Rehm Show, Diane and her guests talk about the broad reach of sequestration. They assess how across-the-board spending cuts are affecting Meals on Wheels, medical research, national parks, and other programs. That's in about 20 minutes at 10 o'clock. If you'd like to join our program, WFAE.org/Charlotte Talks is a supreme way to do that. And we're coming right back.
Hi, it's us, Click and Clack from Car Talk. Hey, Tommy, I finally found something worthwhile to do with your old cars.
Really?
And it doesn't involve Boston Harbor and a trunk full of bricks. Get this, donate your old car today, and we'll turn it into Morning Edition Fresh Air and Car Talk tomorrow.
That's fast.
Well, in your case, we need to move quickly before your car turns to dust. Donate now, you'll get a tax deduction, and we'll even tow it away for free.
Call 1-866-789-8627.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about refugees living in Charlotte, and we have two of them in our studio. Jose Hosmane is a refugee from Havana, Cuba. Came here when he was 10 years old, 12 years ago. Also with us is Mata Arwan, who's a refugee from Sudan. He's been here for how long?
11 years in the U.S.
And how long in Charlotte?
10 years out of.
Okay, because after a year of the snow in Cleveland, you very wisely decided to migrate south. Good move. Sierra Ponce is also with us. She's the Director of Refugee Resettlement for Catholic Charities, and Ellen Dubin is the Executive Director for the Carolina Refugee Resettlement Agency. World Refugee Day is actually tomorrow, but on Saturday from 3:30 to 6, they'll be celebrating this at the 7th Street Market from 3:30 to 6, and you're invited to come and join the refugee community with the resettlement agencies and many others as we observe what goes on in this community that seems to go on absolutely behind the scenes. Not many people know about this. Jose, you have said adapting to a whole new culture and society and way of thinking when you came here at the age of 10 was very challenging for you. What was the whole new way of thinking? You're 10 years old.
Yeah. So basically, when you grow up in Cuba, one thing that happens in a communist country is that everybody becomes involved in a community. You get to know everybody.
Is that because you're told to spy on everybody?
I believe so. I do believe so. We actually have this people called CDRs or CDRs, and you don't know who this individual is. There's one in every neighborhood, and these are individuals who basically report to the government any wrongful doing or anything that they suspect. So we all know there's one in the neighborhood because it's told to you by the government, but we're not told who it is. So what ends up happening is you have a culture that it's very normal for you to go 2, 3, 5, 10 miles down the road and they'll know you. Hey, you're Jose's kid, you know. And that's that coming here to America, where it's normal to live in a house for 20 years and not know your neighbor, was somewhat scary, you know. And you feel alone already because you feel that you're an outcast to society. But that culture on top of everything makes you think, even if I adapt and I learn the culture and the language, this culture seems like they don't get together. So it's very hard, you know, to switch, you know, your thinking from one thing to the other. It took many, 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 many years to adapt to something like that.
Matar, you didn't really have a lot of opportunity to become part of your native culture because you were 5, I think, when you were torn from it and had to walk to a refugee camp, which is not part of your native culture. That's a whole different experience. But how difficult was it to adapt after spending so many years in a refugee camp to a whole new way of life in this country?
It was hard. It was hard for the last couple, for the first 2 years. I had to learn a lot of stuff that, you know, I will think they are easy. Before I came, I was thinking, because we went through what is called culture orientation for 3 days, at least a week before. Yeah.
What did they tell you?
Before you come to the United States.
What did they tell you?
One thing they tell you is about how to respect police, which is...
Respect police?
Yeah. And the importance of 911. And they tell you about American culture.
That's what they tell you?
I mean, there's a couple of things, but the main important thing I asked my, the instructor, is, you know, you need to 911 is one of the important, and you respect the police too, and the culture, especially you don't have to look at somebody for, you know, like staring, but you know, to us where I live, you know, where I come from, or in a refugee camp, you can look at somebody as long as you want to. Like, it doesn't mean you are offend, but they say it mean offense over here. So I had a history of that when I was in my first job, I don't really like to talk to a lot of people, not because I don't want to, but I remember what they told me. You know, you might harassment, you know, not sexual harassment, but just, where you talk, yeah. You might harass somebody. People were easy to get offense. And I was, okay, that's pretty much what I learned in that cultural orientation. But
did you
that's
speak,
not the way.
Did you speak English before you came here?
As an eighth grade, yeah, I speak a little English, but okay. It wasn't that.
Jose?
I did not speak any English. That, to me, coming here, I still remember my first day of school. I had no idea what to do. I got off a bus, and I just kind of followed a group of people, and I sat down in a classroom. I had no idea what I was doing. And the teacher was calling roll. I still remember like it was yesterday. She was calling roll. And after a while, she comes to me. I have no idea what she's saying. And, you know, they basically take me to the front office and get another little girl to translate and basically ask me what I was doing, where I'm going. I told her, I don't know. They just told me to get on this bus and go to school. So that's what I did. So for a while, I was just kind of, they told me, come to this class every morning. So I would get off the bus and I would walk to that classroom. I would sit in the front of the class and I had no idea what was going on.
Now, how can this happen, Sierra and Ellen? You both work with refugees. How can a 10-year-old boy be told to get on a bus and go to a school and not know what he's supposed to do, and for the schools to not know who he is? How can that happen?
That shouldn't happen.
It shouldn't. I was going to say, not in my experience. Yeah. Our caseworkers and Sierra's also from the Catholic Charities will take the parents and children to the international center where they sign up for school. The children are given an English capacity test and get some kind of placement, whether it will be in the ESL, English as Second Language classes, or in mainstream classes, although most of our students go into the ESL programs. Then they're brought to school, to the actual school where they're going. They have to be enrolled in this specific school, and our caseworkers take them to school the first day, make sure that that the students know where they're supposed to be.
You're a stranger in a strange land when you come here as a refugee. And the same would be true if I ended up in France or some
right.
other place.
Right.
What's the most difficult adjustment? Is it the language barrier? Is it the cultural expectations, not knowing what to expect or what is expected of you? Is it the fact that you can only find employment in certain kinds of jobs, even though you're brighter perhaps than they think you are, because you don't speak English well, and so they automatically consider you not as intelligent as the average person. I mean, what's the biggest adjustment?
I think, personally, it's a combination of all. It's a little bit of everything. The language plays a big role. I mean, you can imagine going to France, like you said, and trying to find a job. I mean, there's only, even if there was somebody helping you find a job, there's only so many jobs that you can actually get. So one of the good things that the actual programs put in place do is that they help these refugees find an entry-level job. And when you're coming from a country where you lost everything to a country where you have nothing, you're very grateful to have something. You know, so they'll take any job. They'll take the job that many Americans won't do, for the simple act that this is an opportunity. But it's a huge adjustment. The culture, the language, the way you socialize with people.
Was it more difficult for your father than it was for you?
I think it was, for the simple fact that he had to worry about himself and worry about me as well. Mm-hmm. He's coming as an outcast to a completely new country,
right?
With no language, no profession, because even if he was a doctor in Cuba, that doesn't qualify him as a doctor here. And then on top of that, he has this son, this little kid that he has to raise and, you know, basically make me feel good about being here. So I think it was very tough for
him. How long did it take you, Matort, to feel even remotely comfortable in this country?
It took me 2 years to feel comfortable. And
But it was, I hope that it was better than being in a refugee camp for 13 years.
Absolutely, absolutely. Okay. I mean, to be comfortable, learning the system, getting into the system, you know, it took me 2 years. But in the first day I came, I see the difference of being in a refugee and being in the United States, because we had help from Catholic charity like Sarah said.
What do your organizations do for people? I know that you help them find housing. I know that you help them find a job. I know that you help them get settled. How long does that help from your two agencies continue? Because, first of all, affordable housing in Charlotte, safe housing in Charlotte, is not easy for anyone to find, much less people who don't know anything at all about the United States or about Charlotte, North Carolina. So talk about the help you provide.
You're right, Mike. We provide a comprehensive approach and services for our newcomers, and it begins before they even arrive. Typically, 2 weeks before they arrive, Catholic Charities and CRRA will receive notification from Washington, from our prospective affiliates, and with the State Department, that we have refugees arriving.
And how often does this happen? Is it like once every 2 weeks that somebody new
it
comes?
Varies. It varies. We have no control of the travel arrangements, so it can vary from week to week, from month to month.
All right.
And we are notified about 2 weeks ahead of time. That's realistic. There are times when we have 1 or 2 day notices. And we, in that time frame, our staff have to locate affordable housing, which becomes more and more of a challenge in our area. We have to, with the generosity of the community, support those houses through donated goods, and we purchase items as well. Then we have bilingual staff that meet them at the airport and allow them to come to their new home, give them a very brief orientation because, as you can imagine, they're exhausted.
Yes, and the orientation includes things like how to use the stove, what a thermostat is.
Very basic things. Mm-hmm. Yes.
Turning on and off the water, flushing the toilet. When we were resettling the Somali Bantu, this is a door, this is a doorknob and a key, how you put the key in the door and turn the doorknob to open a door. Very, very basic things. Of course, with other groups, those aren't issues, but there are other issues, and specifically navigating around in their apartments.
A lot of these people have come from deplorable situations and very dangerous situations. I would think that many of them, in some cases, suffer from what we would call PTSD, post-traumatic stress syndrome. And I understand that many of them who might suffer from this come from cultures where there's not even a word for mental pain and anguish. They don't know that there's help available. They don't know that they need help because there's not a word for it. There's not a concept for it. Do you identify that in those folks and help them get help for what they're going through mentally?
When we can identify it, then we do help them get the help. But we... our staff is not always prepared to identify it. We're not specifically trained to, and the health department does not screen for it. However, there are some indications, and we've been taking additional training to try to evaluate and assess what those indications are.
The good thing about these people, one of the many good things, obviously, is that you say, Sierra, that they are resilient. That's something they all seem to have in common.
Yes, tremendous resilience that I think helps them day to day get through all this adjustment that they're experiencing for, you know, their new life here. And some of the concerns you're discussing in regards to the trauma, although we're not trained professionals, we do have the capacity to work with our partners here in the community that we can refer our clients to that can make appropriate assessments of the symptoms that they're displaying and get the help that they need.
And how long do you hang around with these folks? Because it takes longer than 4 weeks for somebody who has no acclimation to the culture whatsoever to acclimate. How long are you in their lives?
A maximum of 5 years, up until citizenship or until eligibility for citizenship.
Do most of them want to become citizens?
Yes.
Do most of them, in fact, become citizens?
Many of them do. Those that don't are afraid to because they're afraid of not passing the test because of the language barrier.
Are either of you citizens yet?
I actually have my oath ceremony tomorrow morning.
Oh, congratulations.
Thank you. Thank you. I mean, touching on what you said, how long they stay with us, in the Catholic program, there was a lady called Linda. I forget her last name. But she actually became very attached to me when I first came to the U.S., and I actually kept communications with her for a very long time, even to this day. Mm-hmm. She tells me all the time that she feels like she's kind of like my mother in a sense. And she's very happy with what I've done with my life, you know, based on the situation I had in Cuba.
What have you done with your life?
Well,
quickly.
Yeah, basically, I'm currently studying political science at the University of North Carolina at Charlotte. I finish my next semester. I have one more semester than I finish, and then I'm applying to law school. So I'm hoping to become politically involved. So it's crazy how everything just kind of connects.
The next president of the United States. Actually, you can't be president.
I cannot. Maybe the next senator to North Carolina.
Mator?
Actually, yeah. I get my citizenship since 2007. And now I'm a U.S. citizen. I vote every single time. That's one of the things I was interested in, you know, getting my citizenship and exercise my rights, because none of us voted before. And it was good experience for me to go to the voting booth for the first time.
I wish we had time to talk about what it takes to become a citizen of the United States, because those of us who are native-born probably couldn't pass the test that you have to take.
That's correct. It's a very tough test.
But we're out of time. Jose Hosmane from Cuba, Mator Ahwan from Sudan.